A strange spiralling white light was spotted in the early morning sky over Sydney, with even sceptical witnesses wondering if it was a UFO.
They were last seen on the beach with a tall man, and that's the best description police have ever had of him.
More than 17 years after Harold Holt disappeared into raging surf at Cheviot Beach, his widow has finally revealed his last romantic words.
Shocking, terrifying, mesmerising. That's the way a number of Australians have described their alleged encounter with the Yowie.
It's time for the Weird Crap in Australia podcast.
Welcome to the Weird Crap in Australia podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Soul. I am, of course, joined by the researcher extraordinaire herself, Holly Soul.
Glitzy and glamorous.
Glitzy and glamorous. A little behind the scenes on this particular episode. Don't worry. Don't give me that look. That look is, if you fucking say anything, I'm going to cut your face off. I've seen that look many times and I still have a face. So, I'm giving it the tongue right now. Oh, that sounded a bit naughty, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Anyway,
moving
on right away from that one. I want to be called the co-writer on this episode. Is that fair?
Sure.
Usually, what would you usually call me? Script editor or, you know, slight contributor?
Person who writes a couple of extra sentences here and there. This time you're an executive consultant.
Co-writer, thank you very much.
Executive consultant, because you didn't write that much. You were just dictating and I was doing the writing.
Yeah, so we really... So this is my fault. This isn't Holly's fault. We'll give you a little behind the scenes here. So Holly said to me a few days ago, hey, I'm having a little bit of trouble with this script. Can you make sure you have a look at it? And I was like, yeah, no worries. I'll have a look at your script. Don't worry about it. And I thought it would be similar. And I shouldn't have done this. And Holly knew that I shouldn't have done this. That's why she was trying to get me to do it earlier. But I'm doing I'm editing Weird Crap in Australia Volume 2. So that's taking up a bit of my time. I'm working on a project that we should be talking about very soon for our Patreon listeners. And what else am I working? Oh, and another comic book of mine is on Kickstarter as well, The Young Adventures of Rufus.
I think last week or it's just closed when this is released. I'm not sure which.
Yeah, I'm sure at this point it's 5,000 out of 8,000 funded, so I'm pretty sure it's happening. We're also still working full-time, right? So there's a lot of stuff going on and we also try and get a little bit of downtime ourselves as well and all this sort of stuff. And I have to start writing Volume 3 soon and I have to start finishing another comic book script. So life is busy for us and there are also all these little projects. And I kept pushing it back, thinking it's okay. I can fix this just like I fix most scripts in my lunch break, you know, which is about an hour. And then things went horrendously wrong at work. My lunch break got shortened to about 40 minutes. And I was like, no, I can still knock this out. Like, I can still get this done. And
then he started opening the script.
Then I read it. And it's no fault of Holly's. Holly, when she's doing the other episodes, there's very little I have to change. It's just like the wording here or there, or maybe you've missed a fact that we've talked about that we wanted to include in the episode. But this, what happens when Holly is super passionate about something, you just have a case of written diarrhea, verbal diarrhea. I don't know how to best to describe it, but it's like you have all these ideas swimming around in your head and you're just like, I got to get them out.
And word then, vomit.
Sorry?
Word vomit.
And then logical reasoned Holly, researcher extraordinaire herself, gets pushed to the wayside so you can get all those ideas out. And so... While I'm at work, there's a certain portion of my day where the store is closed, there are no workers, I get to just sort of be in my own little spot and that gives me a lot more freedom than you would normally expect from the job I have to do. And so here I am doing my work while also, sort of dictating
35 minutes on the phone.
35 minutes on the phone. I'm like, okay, we need to move this paragraph here, structure this, reread this for me. Okay, it should sound more like this. It should do this, should do this. So this script is finalized 10 minutes before I walked through the door, wasn't it? Before
no, it was recording. About 45 seconds because I just turned on a different movie because I'd watched Priscilla yet again.
So, and what was the funniest thing is though, while I'm working away, one of my coworkers walks into my work area and is just listening to me very over the top and sort of exaggerating the way I normally speak. And I'm like, okay, and we need to do this and this and this and this. And I had to then explain to that coworker after the fact. They came back and they're like, were you and your wife fighting? What was going on? I can't understand. You were so intense when you were going back and forth, and I heard the name Holly, so I assumed you were talking to your wife. And I'm like, oh, we were just having a production meeting over the phone. And I then had to explain like the process of like, you write the script, I take a look at it, I do a little bit of, you know, maybe I'll move something around in the structure, or I'll resequence something, or I'll rewrite it a little bit.
Or give it an actual structure.
Or give it an actual structure in this case. So yeah, I'm taking the co-writer credit on this this particular script, because I have put more work into this than I've had to for a long, long time. But it's kind of funny lately. Holly's been operating the board just through necessity, because we're having some sound issues, and we found out that, you know, if we sort of reworked our space a little bit, that there wouldn't be so many problems. And in so doing that, that means that I am now on the opposite side of the table, which I'm not running the board. So
Holly's, I now control the crickets.
Well, yeah. So Holly's running the board and I'm doing more writing. And somehow we've swapped.
Yeah.
Like, we're swapping jobs and it's weird.
I even tried to put sounds on the boards, but my laptop does not want to talk to the board, so no sounds this episode. Sorry, guys.
And the structure changed anyway, so those sounds would have become irrelevant. So yeah, not to bury the lead, episode 164, we are doing a deep dive on an Australian classic film, a cult film, that has sort of become a global phenomena, and that is The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, often misquoted as simply Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which I have done multiple times.
Most people just shorten it to Priscilla or Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. They don't really worry about Adventures of.
Yeah. So just in case I do that on the script, on the script while I'm writing. Man, I am really in the writer's mode right now, aren't I? I am doing this script, as I am performing it, if I accidentally switch back to the shorthand, I apologize.
I'm just going to call it Priscilla the whole way through, so deal.
Yeah. Now, I kind of promised everyone after our last series that we were sort of done with gloom and doom. There are some heady subjects in this as well. And I also noticed, Holly, that we have kind of done an entire like Pride Month, because it's all
I didn't even know that when I set like this up.
Because we sort of thought, well, we picked Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, because we kind of figured we'll need something to lift everyone back up after the last series. But, you know, the themes of the last few episodes are also going to cross into this a little bit as well. But there's also some fun there too.
Glitz and glitter.
We're going to try and – you keep saying that, okay? It's a quote from the movie.
No, it's not.
Isn't it?
No.
Why do you keep saying glitz and glitter?
Because that's all this movie is, really.
Well, see, I always I understand why you would say that. I always think when someone says that, I think 1940s, like classic era Hollywood.
Which is actually what most of the costumes were based around. But yeah, moving on.
Anyway, not moving on. We haven't started yet.
Which means that we need to be moving on.
All right, take it away, Holly. Fresh from Holly's fingertips to your ears, this is The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
To adequately describe the film we're about to discuss is fraught with difficulties. Even going to IMDb is no help, as multiple users have all attempted to narrow down just what the film is all about. User Cinema Fan may get the closest.
Cinema underscore fan, because if you don't say that, Cinema Fan might come after you.
I don't care. Stab me with a stiletto. They might get the closest, so I'll get Matthew to read the synopsis here.
Three friends, three lives, one persuasion, and a pink bus named Priscilla head into the Australian desert with their colourful, extravagant show in a road movie that brings culture clash to the forefront of a comedy of errors. A mixture of vast landscapes, narrow minds, and a melancholy reflective mood that, with the help of a larger-than-life gal, that is Priscilla, she more than widens the comfort zones and finds not just new horizons, but also finds that which is lost. That comes from Cinema underscore Fan on IMDb. I actually think that is the most accurate synopsis for this film.
Whereas I think it falls wide of the mark. So everyone seems to have their own idea of what the film's about. So every synopsis is different, but also the same.
I'll just state this for the record. everyone's interpretation of a film, even though a film is a very literal thing that you can watch and you can sort of pick apart, there's still interpretation, and different things mean different ideas to different people. You know, art is subjective, and that also includes film. However, I will say this, I am right and you are wrong.
And that is the way of art. You're an art critic now, Matthew. Australia as a whole was particularly divided at the time Priscilla was imagined. It was grappling with the idea of progressivism, which was perfectly illustrated in the country versus city dynamic. While the Australian of old was still sitting in his country town, sitting back with a beer watching the footy, his city brethren were embracing a more progressive attitude towards the other. Priscilla attempted, for the very first time, to bridge the cultural gap between urban and rural Australia. In this podcast, as we work through the plot of the film, we will explain to you exactly how a small team of indie filmmakers would successfully bridge that gap.
And I think that's one of the most, and I have to say, I only just watched this film 3 days ago, 4 days ago now.
Thursday, Wednesday.
Yeah. I'd never seen it before. I loved it.
Remembered certain parts of it, so you've either watched it a long, long time ago or you've watched bits and pieces.
Yeah, well, at least now I've actually watched it as an adult and have a full appreciation for it. It does, like, and we're going to go into some of the filming techniques that we used and how they actually incorporated the locals into the movie. But it really is about that. It's about taking something that is beginning to be accepted in the city. You know, there are clubs opening up, there are drag shows occurring, and taking that to people who definitely have no idea of what they're seeing. They have no concept of what's happening, and it definitely does push some buttons. And it's very interesting how this film, I think, helps to bridge that gap. And look, I may be speaking out of my backside at the moment, but I happen to think that it actually worked. I think people attempted to take some very interesting ideas, take some very progressive ideas out into the world, and the world actually responded in the positive for a change.
The director of Priscilla was Stephen Elliott. It's not Stephen, it's Stephen. He directed Frauds, which was a 1993 thriller comedy starring the music of Phil Collins and Mr. Hugo Weaving in the lead.
Now, Hugo Weaving, I love. Phil Collins. Didn't Phil Collins do all the music for Tarzan, the animated
movie? And Brother
Bear,
yes.
Oh, he's such a shit composer. I'm sorry, I hate it because it's like, I think, you know, when you're watching Tarzan, aren't all of the songs just about what's happening, like, right in front of you?
Yes, that's the reason why it killed the Renaissance, but he's not the composer of the film. He's just the guy singing the shit.
Yeah, he also wrote the songs though, didn't he?
He wrote the songs that he sang, but the composer did the soundtrack.
Okay, well,
which was all the shit that doesn't have words.
Okay, well, if in that movie he was the composer, fair enough, but Phil Collins in general annoys the shit out of me, especially because, yeah, he tells you everything that's going on. It's like you look at something around the same time, Toy Story, for example, with Randy Newman, and a lot of people hate Randy Newman as well, but it's like you've got a friend in me perfectly surmises what's happening without being like literal, whereas in the Tarzan movie, it's like, and the parents are on the island and now the parents are dead and the baby's alone, but now it's found a family. And that's exactly what's going on in front of you.
Wrong. What's actually going on in front of you is an internal monologue. Anyway.
You know, film is interpretive, but I am right.
Fuck off, art critic. Now, Stefan actually came out as gay in 2012, which makes this a retroactive gay-led movie, I guess. Stefan was offered to bump the film Frauds to the Cannes LA showing, which meant, of course, that absolutely nothing happened to it and no one has ever actually heard of it.
That's interesting. So he was invited to the... If all of what Holly just said there made no sense to you whatsoever, what happens is if you're an indie filmmaker, you make a film, you then take it to a film festival. Cannes is one of the famous film festivals around the world. So is Sundance. And what it means to bump it is to take it to Cannes, show it off, and try and find a distributor who's going to buy the film.
As a way of dealing with the fact that his film had basically flopped, he went walking around Sydney and ended up in the Oxford Street area where all the gay bars were. Now, they were offering drag shows at the time, but it was done, and I quote him, with no small amount of Australian larrikinism. So they weren't actually trying to impersonate women. They were just glitz, glamouring it, and 5 o'clock shadows.
It's something that's quite interesting because I think Australian culture is now very much associated with drag performers and drag queens. We've talked about this before in previous episodes, and particularly the last three we did. But a drag performer does not necessarily mean that you are homosexual, bisexual, or transgendered.
Half the time it doesn't even mean you're a man.
Yeah, a lot of, well, there are a lot of female
impersonators, yeah.
Yeah, female impersonators. In a lot of ways, it's interesting that it survived so long because it's kind of a stereotype.
Yeah, it is to a point, yeah. But Australian drag's a lot different to American drag, which is different to English drag.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think each set of drag queens sort of has their own particular flavor. And I think when you describe it, Holly, as like this sort of Australian larrikinism, it is. Because it's like your over-the-top lunch lady.
Yeah.
You know, when you I don't know how people do it now, but this is how we used to order our lunch when we got a hot lunch once a week or something like that. I can't remember how often we got to buy our lunches from the canteen. Not too often, because Mum made good lunches. But you would have a brown paper bag, the correct money in the brown paper bag, or maybe you would be lucky enough the canteen would do change for you, which was great because then you could spend the change on an ice cream or something after the fact.
Pocket it, yep.
Right. So you put it in the bag with your order on it, hand it into the canteen, and then at 1 o'clock you'd have your name on it, you'd have your order, same bag, but it was full of some sort of delicious food.
Usually chicken nuggets in our house.
No, we didn't. Chicken nuggets was a special day in the country canteens. You had sausage roll, a mini pizza, or a pie. That was it until I got to high school. And when I got to high school, they actually started doing fast food. Explains why I was so fucking fat.
Elliot eventually ended up sitting around the bars collecting jokes and during a drinking session, of course, because he's Australian, wondered if he could make a musical out of what was going on.
I found myself wandering the streets of Sydney for quite some time there. And at that point in the early 90s, Sydney had sort of come of age. The gay culture had exploded, the dance party scenes had taken off, and suddenly this drag world was sort of evolving. And not in a traditional sense. It's got that great sense of Australian larrikinism to it, which is that everybody was just being excessively naughty. They weren't necessarily impersonating women. They were basically just men in dresses. That comes to us from the DVD commentary of Priscilla, which a lot of his quotes are going to come from there. I haven't listened to the commentary, but I do want to at some stage. Did you enjoy it? Like, this is the first time you've listened to it in years, I would imagine.
12 years, yeah.
Yeah, but it's still good? Like, it still made you laugh?
Yeah, there was still some info in it. He was the only one talking, though, so it was more like an analytics rather than jokes back and forth like some of them are. The first draft of the Priscilla script was written in about 2 weeks and was very light and full of jokes. Essentially, it was just a collection of barroom jokes forced into a light plot poking fun at male cliches.
Now, this isn't something that is too out there for Australian film. One thing that we were really shocked about when we rewatched Crocodile Dundee quite some time ago, and go back and listen to that episode if you missed it, is that the plot of Crocodile Dundee is fairly fucking weak.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, in my brain when I was a kid, split it into two different movies because it's really like, you know, an American reporter rocks up, meets a crocodile hunter, they go back to New York, he finds it weird, then they fall in love. And that's pretty much the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very quick sequence of events. And then if you go back even further, there's this weird softcore porno called Alvin Purple. And I've asked people, some of the people that I know who are really into Australian film, I've asked them to try and explain it to me because I'm pretty sure, okay, so I'm pretty sure this is what happens. Alvin is a super sexy dude for some reason, doesn't look it, is a super sexy dude and people can't help themselves. They keep having sex with him.
Okay.
I think that's what the movie is about.
So fantasy fulfillment for the director or screenwriter or whatever the fuck.
But it's really weak. Like there's really nothing to it. There's really no conclusion to the movie. We're gonna do an episode on it one day because it's been restored and it's now up on Stan for streaming. But, you know, Australian film just had these really weak ass plots. One of our famous monster films, Razorback. It's just about a pig killing people. Now, you may go, well, Jaws is just about Jaws killing people. And it's like, well, there's a lot to it. Like, there's a lot of, you know, the mayor of the town fucks up and it's more involved and Sheriff Brody's worried about his family. And then, you know, there are other characters that have their own take on the situation. Yeah, Australian film just had these sort of really weak plots. Even A Picnic at Hanging Rock, which we haven't done a deep dive on the production of the movie, that will be its own episode. We've only talked about the urban legend concerning it. It just ends. It just feels like it ends. And that's all there is to it. You know, it's kind of weird that Australian cinema just avoided plot and story. But Priscilla is obviously in its first draft, which gets us back on board to the script. Sorry, I love movies. I love these episodes.
Which is why you should be the one writing these fucking episodes.
It is interesting that when we go back to Priscilla, like that's how its origins start, as one of those really basic bones, jokey, you know, films, like Australian films.
If different characters and events were based on people that Elliot knew, both in and out of the drag world. The main characters, Tick, Adam, and Bernadette, were based on real queens. Now, his final inspiration for the movie struck at Mardi Gras 1992, when a wig was blown off a drag queen's head and bounced down the street, tumbling away like a tumbleweed.
I hope the performer turned around and go, "My hair!" and chased it down in a very, like, up.
Platform heels.
Yeah, yeah, it just would have been
sequin ball gown.
I hope they played into it a little bit. But that, I kind of like that. It's that one moment of inspiration, you know, where you just see something. You just see it for a minute and you're like, that could be an idea. You know, when we started writing Killaroo Semper Fi, the idea was, wouldn't it be cool if the Killaroo was the Predator from the movie Predator? That's it. That's where we started. And then it evolved from there. And sometimes it's just that little tiny thing. Or you can be like the Wachowski sisters and just rip off three animes and make The Matrix, but I digress.
Elliot took scripts to different drag queens, hoping to use them and their costumes for it, but they didn't want to know them after reading said script. Not surprising, considering how shit the plot was. They held a drag queen party, hoping to entice the queens in, and of course only two or three showed up. They got really drunk, and the filmmakers got absolutely jack shit of research material out of them. Elliot ended up shopping it around to PolyGram,
Sorry to cut you off again. I don't even think PolyGram exists anymore, does it?
No, I don't think it does.
No, I recall it. Like, I remember PolyGram films, but I don't think they exist.
I haven't seen their ticket on something that isn't from the 90s.
Yeah. Because they did a lot of, like, there was a couple of rom-coms. I think they worked with Guy Pearce again after this.
Probably. He was the hottie out of the group, so why not?
Hey, well, to be fair, out of all of them...
He's the man candy.
He's the man candy. Like, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely not Hugo Weaving.
PolyGram ended up dropping 50% of the funding for the film, and the Australian Film Finance Corporation dropped the other 50%.
Yeah, and if you remember our episode on Saw, you'll remember it was the Australian Film Finance Corporation that did not drop any money on Saw and lost Australia one of the most profitable horror franchises of all time.
They eventually made the film on a $2.7 million budget.
Which is not too bad for the 90s.
One of the dresses cost them $7.
Yeah. Well, another film that would have been a contemporary of this, obviously radically different genres, but Clerks came out around the same time, and Clerks was made on a budget of $70,000, I believe. It's between $40,000 and $70,000, all paid with credit card after credit card after credit card after credit card.
But in America, you can do that because they just keep sending you credit cards.
And that's what Kevin Smith said. He just kept filling out application forms. So, I mean... I think 2.4 and the 2.4 million speaks to the overall 2.7 million actually speaks to the overall look of the film, which actually does look quite good. And then when you factor in inflation, you're probably looking at what, 7 mil?
5 or 6.
Yeah, because when we covered Saw, which came out way after this, 700,000 was their total budget.
Yeah, and they had lots of fake blood to cover.
Yeah.
Because of the AFFC involvement, only one non-Australian actor was actually allowed to be cast in the film. While fundraising at Cannes, they were going to host a drag party to launch fundraising for more, but the queens they hired didn't show. I'm sensing a theme.
What's the go here? Is it just drag queens in the 90s were unreliable? Is it that
the drag
got
scene
scared?
Is full of drugs and alcohol? What do you think happened?
So they were unreliable because they were drugs.
They were hungover, or they were still high, or they were still coming down, or they just couldn't be asked, or all kinds of stuff.
That's me. That was me over the last. When I had my holiday not too long ago, and I tell you what, I was fucking useless to everybody.
Yep. And that's why you don't get legitimate queens to do stuff.
Because I had 2 weeks off with you and then 2 weeks off without you. And you'd walk in the door and you'd be like, you're already drunk, aren't you? Baby, I've been drunk all day.
I woke up drunk. Various members of the crew, including Elliot, his executive producer, and the costume designer, were forced to put on drag and perform to keep the momentum going and raise funds.
It was just preposterous. The whole thing started falling apart, and somehow people just started giving us money.
I think they thought they might have been strippers and were just like layering the stage.
Look, you get drunk enough and the makeup is good enough, you know, you'll take a drag queen home, absolutely. And the only problem is when the wig comes off and it's like Gus, and Gus thinks that you invited him around for more booze and football, that it becomes very, very awkward.
The girdle comes off and you're like, oh, you don't have an hourglass figure. Damn.
Put the wig back on.
Elliot brought along members of his team on frauds and set about working out casting. John Cleese was approached for the role of transgender character Bernadette, but he declined.
That's interesting, John, because we're going to talk about some alternate casting, obviously. John Cleese, I don't mind at all. And the reason I say that is because we recently, you watched for the first time, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein from the 90s, directed by Kenneth Branagh, who is so sexy as
he's the main candy of that film.
There's a point where he's working on a corpse and he's in this beautiful flowing robe. And I'm like, for fuck's sake, Kenneth Branagh, this is such a vanity piece. But John Cleese is in that with like that long old school English hair. And now that I think about it, he could have done this.
The Python boys did a lot of cross-dressing. I think by that point he's like, I'm not doing any more, thanks.
Probably, because they were often complimented on how much more attractive they look with in dresses.
Yeah, that's why Eric Idle and Michael Palin stopped doing it.
Yep.
Colin Firth was asked to play Tick, but declined. Tim Curry was even considered for Bernadette, but they decided against actually approaching him.
Colin Firth is an interesting one. I mean, obviously, our favourite movie with Colin Firth in it is...
Daredevil?
That's Colin Farrell.
Oh, is it? Oh, it must be Kingsman then.
Thank you, Holly. Thank you. Yes, Kingsman.
I confused the two of them, okay? One's the Irish guy and one's the Kingsman guy.
So I think like a young Colin Firth. I kind of see that. Mm-hmm. Tim Curry obviously is approached after, you know, the Rocky Horror Picture Show becomes one of the most successful independent cult films of all time. It's constantly showing everywhere. I can understand why I can understand the drive to do that, because it'd be great marketing, be great PR. You could really get your film up and running. However, completely wrong casting.
Yeah.
Like, so far from correct casting that it would have only been considered by financial reasons. Not that I hate Tim Curry. I fucking love Tim Curry. I love his performance in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. But he's just too severe for the role.
And at that point, he would have been pushing 50 as well. So yeah. You wouldn't have had the same pretty boy lure that he did back then.
Well, and I mean, Bernadette is an older transgender woman, right? A post-op transgender woman. So, you know, the age isn't really the concern. It's just there also is a softness to the character that I don't think he could have brought to the role.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Eventually, the team returned to fraud star Hugo Weaving and cast him as Tick. Terrence Stamp, famous for his role as General Zod in the Christopher Reeve Superman films.
Can I?
Yeah, go for it.
Kneel before Zod.
He was approached to play Bernadette opposite Hugo Weaving. Initially, Stamp was hesitant, but realizing that he was being typecast as the British villain, said sod it and signed on.
Yeah, and that was because of Superman.
Elliot actually has a slightly different version of that event.
Mm.
He says that Stamp was marching into his agent's office to quit. His agent went, well, here, try this one, threw the script at him, and Stamp went, yeah, no, I'll do that.
Well, I mean, that's kind of the it is the same story in a lot of ways. Like, if he was quitting because he's like, I can't do this, like, I can't just be
the English bad guy.
Because he was a Bond villain as well, wasn't he, Terrence Stamp? Mm-hmm. But yeah, when I was growing up, it was obviously, you know, you had that nice British accent, and he played a wonderful General Zod, and his back, because we only recently watched Superman mm-hmm. 2, director's cut or the
long one.
The long one, so director's cut, yeah. We only recently rewatched it, and he's wonderful in it. Like, he's got this amazing performance. He's got this amazing gravity. But, yeah, he started being typecast as the British villain, which is great if you constantly want work, but also sucks if you want to be an actor.
Yeah, if you want to do something different with your life.
Yeah, like, you know, it's like you look at the early career of Steve Carell. It's only until the later years does he get to now do dramatic roles like Foxcatcher and The Big Short and Vice. Speaking of which, Donald Rumsfeld actually kicked the bucket the other day, the character he portrays in Vice.
Yeah.
Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld actually died. So there goes one war criminal.
Terrence Stamp suggested Bill Hunter for the role of Bob, and he accepted without looking at the script. This would later become an issue as he was filming Priscilla and Muriel's wedding in two places in the country at the same time with differing amounts of facial and hair.
Ugh. Muriel's wedding is one that we will do.
Never seen.
I have watched it 12 times because I did advanced English for it is when it's every day in pieces during your lunch because that's the only time they had to teach us advanced English. My problem was I was too smart for regular English, but I was too dumb for advanced English.
That was me, math.
Yeah, so I ended up doing advanced English and also extension English, and extension English happened during our lunchtime. So once a week I had to sacrifice it, and then I was forced to watch Muriel's Wedding, and then failed anyway, so it sucked ass.
Finally, when they were running out of time and options, they signed a Neighbours graduate, Guy Pearce, to play Adam, the last of the trio.
So he was a Neighbours boy. I thought he was a Home and Away boy.
No, he's a Neighbours boy. I think it was Mark or Mick or something like that.
Right. So Australia, if you don't know, is famous for two soap operas. The first being Neighbours, which is exported all across the world, and so is its counterpart, Home and Away. If you have seen an Australian actor in anything, generally speaking, that's where they come from. You love Margot Robbie in Suicide Squad? Home and Away. You love Chris Hemsworth as Thor? Home and Away.
Kylie Minogue, Neighbours. Delta Goodrum, yeah, Neighbours.
You know, all of these sort of actors eventually made their way out of soapies.
He was literally hired as eye candy, as we've said, and Elliot took every opportunity he had to make Guy Pearce take his shirt off because that's the draw card.
Well, he is handsome. Like, he's a young, handsome man.
And he was real buff back then.
You know, I'm comfortable enough in my sexuality to say that. He's a very handsome dude. He kind of has that real gruff look now.
Yeah.
You know, he's aged differently. I'm not going to say he's aged well or aged badly. He's just aged differently.
He's no longer Superman. He's turning into old Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. Actually, it's fine. I could see Guy Pearce playing an old Bruce Wayne, actually.
Alongside, what's his name, from 89? Tim Burton's Batman.
Oh, Michael Keaton.
Yes.
Who is actually going to be playing Old Man Batman.
Put those two together, Aldrich Killian and Old Man Batman. There you go. While there were members of the crew that spent time working on Frauds, other members of the crew, especially around costume and makeup, spent time working with drag queens to perfect the look.
So, Holly, you actually have something in here that you've basically just said, Matthew needs to talk about this. And that's basically about the crew learning guerrilla filmmaking techniques and also having to learn about the culture of drag performing as production got underway. And that also included the main characters. So let's talk a little bit about guerrilla filmmaking here and what it exactly entails.
Well, the first thing I'd like you to do is actually to read this quote because it's
the start. Oh, you want me to read the quote first?
It's the start of where they built the characters for later shots.
Okay, I'll do that and then I'll go on a big one.
Yeah.
According to director Stefan Elliott, he took the three leads out in drag prior to the beginning of filming. None of them was recognized. Guy Pearce took the opportunity to be outrageously rude. Terence Stamp eventually forgot he was in drag and started hitting on girls. Typical old British man. And Hugo Weaving got super drunk, lay under a table for hours, tapping his finger in time to the music. This last detail was incorporated into the film in the hotel room scene. That's pretty fucking amazing, actually.
And then that scene was later used in Broken Hill. That was the inspiration for the Broken Hill scene.
Yeah, another great scene in the film.
Anyway, speaking of Broken Hill.
Okay, guerrilla filmmaking. Guerrilla filmmaking is something where you have a limited budget, limited time, limited resources, so you may just sort of, you know, skip things.
Right? Like permits.
You may not have the right permits. One of the most famous sequences for not having a permit, Terminator 1. Now, do you remember the scene? Like, she's killed the Terminator, Carl Reese is dead, and she is walking towards the horizon. And it's just, you know, see, the problem is, and this drives me nuts.
See,
Holly cannot appreciate Terminator 1 and 2.
See, if you'd said Deadpool and the bridge scene, I would have been right there beside you. But yeah, nah, Terminator, no.
Right? Because what drives me nuts, and I've tried to explain, Holly loves Titanic, which I think is a bloated mess of a film. It's too long.
It's good for wasting 3 hours.
No, you don't waste time, all right? You watch good movies or really bad movies and make fun of them, which we also do. Right. The plot of Terminator and Titanic are the fucking same. Right? Replace iceberg with robot and you basically have the same characters doing the exact same thing, right? Both male leads die at the end of the film. Both of the women are from completely different cultures, right? And both men impart something to the women that helps them become either stronger or more, you know, independent, or in Sarah Connor's case, a fucking badass for Terminator 2. It's the same movie, people. And one is far better than the other. Anyway, so at the end of Terminator 1, there is a scene where Sarah Connor is walking along, is cruising along a stretch of road. You know, it's in the desert. Now, James Cameron didn't have a permit for this. And when they were pulled over by a traffic cop, the traffic cop said, "What are you guys doing out here?" And he said, "Oh, we're just film students making a student movie." And he's like, "Well, I'll let it pass this time, but most of the time you need a permit. So make sure that you file the appropriate paperwork for the next movie." And I just love the idea of the cop sitting down in front of that movie screen watching Terminator being like, "Those motherfuckers, but this is a really good movie." So I think he was probably happy with the end results. Now, where this applies to Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and another film I mentioned earlier, Clerks, that's all guerrilla filmmaking, all of that. When it comes to the adventures of Priscilla, what they had to do was they couldn't really hire hundreds of extras. It would have been too expensive. Hiring an extra is not cheap because they know the union rules very, very well, especially in America. And it's not, you know, they know how to, like, if they're on screen for more than a few, you know, certain amount of times, if they bring their own costume, they know about all the different perks they can get. There are some people that make a substantial living just by being an extra.
I mean, there's one dude that's like, that's all he does. He's in everything.
Yeah. You're just a professional extra in films. Now, in my opinion, in a very clever thing that is done in this film is that they worked with the people of Broken Hill. So they had our three main actors walk through the town, all the reactions are genuine. And then during the bar scenes, all of the reactions are genuine. And what that means is you don't have to convince your audience that everyone in the bar is having fun because they're having fun.
Yeah.
You don't need to have the old man's hat fall off the back of his head as he sees three drag queens walking through his small rural town because it happens naturally. And the one thing that I love the most, and it definitely reminds me of old Australian ladies, all the nanas out there, you all know who I'm talking to, because there are all these sweet, adorable grandmothers seeing these men in drag and they're loving it. They've got the biggest smiles on their faces, and you're saving money on extras. You're involving the community into your production, which is really going to help production.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting genuine reactions, which helps to, you know, it helps your audience to buy into the authenticity of what they're seeing. So it's very, very clever. Honestly, like A++++ on guerrilla filmmaking, but that's what you're doing. You're basically using free elements all around you to make a film as authentic and as quickly and as cheaply as possible, and you usually skip a permit or two. I don't think they needed permits in Broken Hill, though. We're a bit more relaxed than America.
No, in the audio commentary, he specifically said we didn't have a permit for it, so they were just like walking around with the camera at like knee height filming and stuff like that.
Well, there you go. Man, I have in my like, fuck, man, we did a lot of filming without permits for the Modern Meltdown.
From this point on, what we're going to do is we're going to take key scenes out of the movie and we're going to assess it against cultural impact and its context and stuff like that. So we won't be talking about the entire movie, just certain parts of it.
Yeah. So we're going to basically describe scenes. We're going to talk about why they're important to, you know, why we think they're important. And we're going to talk about why they became cultural icons after the fact. If you've ever listened to the podcast Office Ladies, which has two actresses from The Office, if you're a fan of it, I'd recommend it. It's quite good. They do the same thing where they just take like key segments of the episode. And that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to take key segments of the film and then we're going to explain why they're so significant.
And this is definitely going to be our first pop culture two-parter because we're already at 40-odd minutes.
yeah, which is crazy. This has never happened before.
That's how much I love this film. Priscilla opens to a performer standing on stage in full drag in a bar in Sydney. This is Mitzi the Magnificent. Main character Mitzi was based on a real-life story of drag queen Cindy Pastel, who was a prominent AIDS campaigner in the 1990s, a drag queen known to frequent the Imperial Hotel. Tick slash Mitzi was played by Hugo Weaving, now known best as Elrond or Agent Smith.
Destroy the ring, Isildur. Actually, I probably butchered that quote.
Probably, yeah.
Destroy it! No. Isildur!
So there are a lot of angry Lord of the Ring fans who are really fucking angry with me right now. What about... why am I fucking blanking on this? This is actually pissing me off. I'm trying to think
of
one
of the rings, so I don't care.
Well, I was trying to think of one of his like Agent Smith lines. It's like
Mr. Anderson.
Anderson.
Never send a human to do a machine's job.
Yeah, but Hugo Weaving, quite a prolific actor. Most people would know him, like I said, Elrond in Lord of the Rings. He was Agent Smith in The Matrix. He was the voice of Megatron in those awful Michael Bay Transformers films. I don't fucking care what anyone says. Come at me. I'm on Twitter, at WeirdCrapInOz. Come get me.
I'm actually pretty sure this is only his second acting credit, the first one being Frauds beforehand.
And of course, he's the Red Skull in Captain America the First Avenger. That is Hugo Weaving under all of that makeup.
And CGI.
Yeah, that's right. They had to digitally remove his nose, didn't
and
they?
And angle up the cheekbones a little bit, yeah.
However, he did not go back to reprise the role when they did the Spectre in Endgame. So there you go. But yeah, Hugo Weaving, one of our most beloved actors and really has had a cultural impact too.
Mostly TV, and then he had like four or five tiny ones, and then it was Priscilla.
I've watched one of the miniseries when you talk about TV. Is that the one, it's about the farming property? I think it's like a mini series, a two-part mini series. I can't remember what it's called, but I have watched it.
There are so many like mini series, TV series, stuff like that. So Dirty Water Dynasty, maybe?
That's the one. That's the one. I have seen these. Very good in that, actually.
Mitzi slash Tick is a drag queen stuck in a rut and hating his job. Now, his actual job is selling facial cream for the more heavy-duty woman in us all, which is actually a line in the film.
I like, and it's on the
woe
creams.
Man.
Yeah, woe man. For the heavy duty woman in us all.
He's essentially a glorified Avon lady.
If you don't know what an Avon lady was, these people were spectacular. There were two ladies in your life back in the early 90s and 80s and 70s, 60s. You had your Tupperware lady. She'd have a Tupperware party and sell a bunch of Tupperware. And you had your Avon lady. And your Avon lady would sell you makeup. You know, they'd be like, hey, come to our Avon party, and they'd throw a little party, and then you fill out your little form, and then you get all your makeup, or they'd give you a call, or they'd be roaming around with a bag of makeup.
Go watch the first 15 minutes of Edward Scissorhands. There's an Avon lady right there.
That's right, yeah. His adoptive mum is an Avon lady, yeah. Because she fixes him up or tries.
Yeah.
She does her best.
After a show where he's assaulted when someone hits him in the back of the head with a can of beer, he receives a call from his estranged wife asking him to come to Alice Springs with a show to run the place for 4 weeks. Playing Mitzi's foil is the flamboyant Adam / Felicia, played by Guy Pearce, now known best as Aldrich Killian from Iron Man 3 or Leonard from Memento.
I feel kind of bad about our two references there because that was the best thing I could come up with off the top of my head. He's got to... Well, there's a more famous role.
The fact that they were the ones that were on top of your head means they're probably the ones that he's most famous for.
Well, yeah, Memento is a big deal. That's a Christopher Nolan movie. It's one of the very few Nolan movies I have not seen and have not watched, but he was big in that. He was also in that really bad Alien prequel movie, Prometheus. He plays the old guy, the founder, and he's like, hello, daughter, you know, I've come to talk to aliens or some bullshit. That's also Guy Pearce. So he does pop up a lot. You probably have seen a movie he's in. Famously or infamously, because they did the whole Mandarin double take, he was in Iron Man 3.
He was so convincing in Priscilla that the rumors he's actually gay still follow him today, even though he's turned around and said, I am straight. I am straight as a fucking arrow. Will you give it a fucking rest? The duo would not be complete without the intro to our third character, Bernadette, played by Terrence Stamp, who we've already talked about. So Matthew wants to do his General Zod impression again, I assume.
No. Well, we are looking for Planet Houston, which is another one. Terrence Stamp was the big bad in a lot of movies. One thing I will say though, like obviously in the 90s, the idea that Guy Pearce was gay did dog him a lot. I'd say in retrospect of nearly a 20-year-old movie, it is a pretty campy depiction.
Oh, it is camp as fuck.
You know, just because I've known, you know, people like I've known the gay community for quite some time. I'm sure that there are people like that, but they're very far and few between, and they're a lot less over the top.
Depends on what environment they're in. If they're in the middle of like a gay nightclub, they are flamboyant as fuck, but on the street, they're like kind of reserved.
I've been in the middle of a gay nightclub, but I was pretty drunk, and you were there. Yes. Made out.
No, we didn't. Who were you kissing? Uh-oh.
Okay, well, no, that was you, right? Anyway, I have to reassess some old memories.
It's worth noting here that the three characters together embody three different aspects of what I call the rainbow community. Instead of saying the LGBTQIA every other letter.
There were only three in the 90s. Technically two and a half.
There were actually four.
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah.
LGBT four.
Yeah.
It's been tacked on a lot since then. That's why it's now the rainbow community.
In the 1990s, basically, it was understood that homosexuals existed. It was understood that lesbians existed. Bisexuality was still a fringe, even for the homosexual community. It was still a fringe idea, and they explore that a little bit in the movie. We'll talk about that a bit later on, or probably in part two at this point. Of course, people were now having gender realignment. Realignment surgery? Is that right? Gender alignment surgery? I think it's alignment surgery, not realignment.
I don't know.
I can't remember. So, you had transgender folk, you had lesbians, gays, and you had bisexuals as well. And that was it. It was really the four in the early days.
That's why it's so hard to remember how many letters there are now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always... I generally say LGBT, not because I'm an asshole, just because that's how I remember it. You know, when I was younger, that's what it was. And I'm in my early 30s now. That was the big one. That was the banner. And transgenderism and also bisexuality were definitely overshadowed just by
gay and lesbian.
Lesbian, gay. And that's even when they did Mardi Gras, lesbian, gay.
Letter. Adam explicitly states he's gay, Bernadette is a transgender woman, and Tick has no idea what he is.
He actually says in a moment here in this particular scene, he's like, I don't know. Like, they say to him, like, are you gay? Are you straight? Because at one point, Guy Pearce's character, I think, feels betrayed. And one of the interesting things that the director does here is sort of express an idea that I think was, it's less popular now, but was popular within the gay community in the 90s, was the...
The bis are just greedy.
Yeah, there was like almost a distrust of bisexual people.
Or they're just pretending. Yeah.
You know, it's like every single group. And I always say this, like, regardless of which group you fall into, there are biases everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've met some homosexual men who are incredibly misogynistic. You know, I've met, I know of people within the lesbian community who are domestic abusers. Like, no single community is free from shitty elements. And so, yeah, when it came to the lesbian and gay community in the 1990s, they were very apprehensive of people claiming to be bisexual.
Or even just perceived to be bisexual.
Yeah, exactly.
As such, each of the characters each have their own battles and changes to undertake in their travels. At their first stop in Broken Hill, New South Wales, Tick and Adam head off down the main street in drag, with Bernadette following sedately behind.
You see all these smiling grannies as they walk past them?
It's like Tick grabs a bunch of like flowers and sniffs them and it's, oh, lovely, and keeps walking, and the ladies just breaks out in a grin.
Yeah, because there's almost an element, and we'll probably have to leave it here, actually.
This Holly, will be it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then we'll pick it back up in part two, because if you haven't seen The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, stop what you're doing, pop it in, and then you'll enjoy the second half a lot more.
Don't forget your martini or your daiquiri or anything like that.
I think I had ciders left over from a bad movie night, so thanks to my brother and friends for leaving those in the fridge. Definitely helped with the bad movie we watched, Rise of Skywalker. Jesus fucking Christ. So, you know, there is an element of drag queen that actually reminds me a lot of like classic clowning.
Yeah.
You know, the over-exaggerated makeup, the over-exaggerated voices, the performative element of it is definitely, if I can be a little bit of a drama nerd here, it's, you know, that commedia dell'arte, the, you know...
Fuck me, I have no idea what that is.
you probably know the characters, though, Punch and Judy, where yeah. It's, you always see the puppets with the long nose and it's like, nah, nah, and they're beating the crap out of each other. Of course... The scene you would remember is from The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Oh, I was actually thinking Santa Claus.
Oh, well, that's interesting. But I always think of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, where the carnival is in town and he's doing the little puppet show and they're beating each other up with sticks. That's Punch and Judy. And that's essentially the beginning of clowning.
Mm-hmm.
So all the archetypes that were established during the Commedia dell'arte, which is also, if you want to go further back, is also based on like, you know, the Greek plays and the Greek tragedies and things like that, where these archetypes were established. God, I've gone so nerdy, I've gone cross-eyed myself and now I forget where I am. There is an element of clowning to drag queens.
Well, the idea is to draw attention to yourself and you need to be bigger and louder than life to do that.
The hair, the costume, the voice.
The eyebrows that are halfway to your fucking hairline.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it is so indicative performance-wise of clowning, you know. And I find that very, very interesting. Like, I am within a sphere of creators and stuff like that I've now found myself a part of. And hopefully we'll get to see him on stage because he's been cast in the show. I believe Tim, Big Tim Styles, is a massive drag queen fan because he's always tweeting about it. Like, he watches RuPaul's Drag Race. He's going to be in the Q production of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. I'm not sure which character he's playing, but we're going to go see it. It's going to be wonderful. You know, but, you know, wife, daughter, like, he just loves...
Straight as an arrow, just likes the costume.
Well, I don't know if he is or not. Like, I'm not going to ascribe anyone's gender to this them or true. Sexuality. But, you know, it's that performative element that I understand, like, the attraction to. Because when we've cosplayed, when I get to put on my whole Batman suit, you're a different person.
You can hide.
And you can... Well, not so much hide, but you can perform for people. And so as a cosplayer, well, ex-cosplayer, because we haven't really done it for a long time.
Just Halloween.
Well, actually, yeah. Well, even when we did Halloween and I did the whole Jason Voorhees Friday the 13th, which I've wanted to do for a long time, and I made my own mask and it was quite a lot of fun. You get to be someone else. You get to perform. You get to enact out all your, you know, if you're a quiet, meek individual, well, you slap on some lipstick, you put on a wig, you put on some crazy eyeliner. You can be bombastic and you can really push yourself out there and you can have fun.
Well, I think the entire idea at the beginning was probably if I wear such eccentric makeup and the wigs and the hair, nobody's going to know it's me. Yeah. I can get this out of my system and it won't come back to bite me in the ass.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure for some people, there were some men who liked wearing women's clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this allowed them to, you know, be closer to who they were. You know, there is an element of transgenderism for a lot of people. Like that was a way to explore that without exploring it or without being public about it. But for a lot of other people, they also got to be crazy clownish entertainers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just recently there was a controversy last year where they had a drag queen at a library doing a reading because that guy loves to perform. And there's nothing more colorful to kids. Kids in Australia love drag queens. They love them. I loved them when I was a kid. They were so visually interesting.
There's a meme that goes around. They're like, all right, so what do you think about drag queens and kids? Like, kids should not be allowed around drag queens. There will be nails broken. There will be wigs torn. It is not a good idea.
Yeah, it's the drag queens that need to be protected from the kids, not the other way around.
Anyway, they we've bite. Gone on a bit too long.
Kids bite. Anyway, that was a particularly long pop culture inspired episode, which is awesome. We're going to cover part two next week. Hope you'll join us for that. Let's talk about a couple of things here very quickly. We'll do a quick bit of housekeeping. You're going to see a few little changes around social media and things like that. On Patreon, for example, we've changed a few names and the tiers. And we're doing that just because we're doing a little bit of a revamp. So don't worry, we haven't been bought by an evil corporation. We're not
Although we're open to office.
Yeah, fucking hard. We're not doing anything crazy. It's just you'll notice a few little things that are going to be updated. Nothing to be alarmed about. Speaking of Patreon, this is something pretty exciting. We're introducing for our $5 a month subscribers an extra little bonus. And that is, I am recording the audiobook for Weird Crap in Australia, Volume 1. And this is the first time we've ever done this, and we don't know if this is going to work. So what we're going to do is we're going to release it chapter by chapter. Sometimes you get a bit bonus because you'll get a chapter and an introduction. So you get a little twofer. We're going to be doing that chapter by chapter, and that's going to be going straight to Patreon. So if you're one of those people who would desperate for the audiobook, and we thought it was kind of redundant because we do the podcast, this is what you've been after. And for that $5 a month, you'll get a chapter of the audiobook. You will get the mainline episodes completely ad-free. You will get a mini-sode. That's three things for only $5 a month.
And any interviews that we happen upon the way.
Absolutely.
If Stephen Elliott wants to talk to us, we'll... Yeah. We're happy with that.
Yeah, oh, I'd love to talk to him. I really would. I'd love to pick his brain about all the different filmmaking techniques in the movie. So yeah, we're just looking to add value. Like, we don't like to take people's money without making sure you have something in return. And I kind of feel like, you know, essentially a free audiobook that you're getting week to week to week is kind of a, you know, plus the minisode, plus the ad-free episodes is pretty good value for $5 a month.
Yeah.
If I was contributing $5 a month to one of my favorite podcasts and I got all that content, I think Last Podcast on the Left does stuff like that. Like, they're pretty good with content as well. You know, that, and that's always at the forefront. I'm always thinking, how can I add more value to this? So by the time you listen to this, hopefully some of those episodes will be up. I'm trying to get about four ahead, and then I'm just going to go week to week from that point on. So that's coming to you guys. Again, will that be considered the official audiobook? Will it be re-edited? I don't know, but this is an experiment. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to at least share it with someone. So you can check that out.
Can you hear something? That's Blake screaming in the background.
No, I've talked to him about this. I'm editing this one.
Okay.
I'm not increasing his workload. I've already promised that I won't. I have talked to him about the idea and, you know, he suggested, well, Weird Crap in Australia, Volume 2, our second book, is coming out towards September.
It's less than a month from the time this comes out.
Wow. So less than a month from now, you'll be able to pick up Weird Crap in Australia Volume 2. And he thought it'd be a good idea to lead it up to Weird Crap in Australia Volume 2. So if you've never listened to the podcast that we talked about in our first book, you don't really have time to read a book. I am going to be reading the book to you chapter by chapter on Patreon with all the extra bonus stuff for only $5 a month. So that's pretty exciting.
You can set it to fall asleep too.
Yeah, you can. You'll be able to listen to that. And that will come out on the, basically, our Patreon subscribers, they get their own little extra exciting feed, and they'll be able to listen to that just like they're listening to the rest of those episodes, the mini-sodes, the ad-free stuff, all the interviews, it's all there for you. Now, another thing just quickly with the Patreon as well, you'll see a couple of design changes and we're renaming names of tiers. The tiers aren't changing except for the $5 tier, which now has the bonus audiobook part, but it's just renaming because we're just doing some fun stuff there, just trying to add a bit of excitement, revamp. It's always fun. What else can I talk about? Well, Volume 2 is coming out September. Weird Crap in Australia, Volume 2. I think it's a better book than the first one, honestly.
It's definitely longer.
Oh, it's so much longer. It's a lot longer. It's nearly, what, 50 pages more?
At least, yeah.
And I just re-edited the Comic Book Killer episode, which I think took it to another page.
Yay.
Yay. So that's all going on as well. Killaroo Semper Fi, that's my latest comic. That's coming to stores very soon, October. You should see that here in your comic book stores if you haven't checked it out. You'll be able to pick yourself up a physical copy of that. The Young Rufus Adventures, which I also wrote a story for, that'll be coming out probably a few months after that as well. So that's probably more 2022. Don't forget to keep the conversation going. Do you have any personal connections to a drag queen? Are you a drag queen and you'd like to talk to us?
Ooh, can we do a promo shot if there's one in Canberra?
Of?
Us dressed as drag. As long as the drag queen does the makeup because I'm really, really shit at makeup.
I mean, I don't want to shave my beard off.
There are drag queens that have beards and moustaches, dude.
Yeah, but if I want to do it, I want to do it properly and that'd be no beard. And I don't want to shave my beard off because it keeps
me warm. Well, then you don't want to do it properly then, do you?
No, I don't because I want to do it properly, but not enough to sacrifice my beard. That's all. You know, I've seen our editor in drag because his partner is a makeup artist.
He's and definitely man candy like that. Yeah,
he's done pretty well, I think. He makes a very convincing drag queen. I think he should do it professionally. I think he should give up his day job, stop editing this podcast.
No, don't say that.
Become a full-time drag queen. No, we love him on the... Like, we wouldn't want to lose him, but I'd also like to... Like, we'll help him out. We'll be tour managers or something. So keep the conversation going. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram, both as Weird Crap in Australia, and you can find me lurking around on Twitter. My handle is @ Weird Crap in Oz, AUS. If you'd like to get in contact with us to talk about today's episode or anything in particular, shoot us an email to weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com. And that's also for interview requests and any businesses who want to work with us. Feel free to drop us a line, weirdcrapinaustralia@gmail.com. If you want to get some Weird Crap in Australia merch, don't forget merch store is weirdcrapinaus.redbubble.com. Grab a t-shirt. Grab two t-shirts and a sticker. Grab two t-shirts, a sticker, and a magnet.
I'm just going to be as quiet as I can for as long as I can and see how many things you can list.
I'm not going to keep doing that. I think that's all the plugging I have to do. So, as is customary, we're going to hand over the last words of the podcast to the wonderful researcher extraordinaire herself.
The only thing this movie was missing was a koala because there's a kangaroo.
That's true. There were some emus in it.
Yeah, they were emus.
Or men dressed as emus, I'm not sure.
It was just no koalas.
Very good pointing that one out there. Thanks so much for joining us for Weird Crap in Australia. It's a bit more of a lighthearted episode, and we got some more lightheartedness coming your way. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Bye for now.
The Weird Crap in Australia podcast is hosted and produced by Holly and Matthew Soul. Our editor is Blake Kell. Weird Crap in Australia is a production of The Modern Meltdown.